Thank you, Pam. I'm going to ask our marshal to call the next case to order.
Calling case number A220238, State of Minnesota versus Wayne Allen Bothune.
This matter appears on our Court of Appeals Zoom calendar today. Thank you for appearing on this platform. I want to remind you that the rules of appellate procedure remain intact despite the fact we are appearing by Zoom. Please indicate your name and who you're speaking on behalf of before you begin making your argument. Also, we have, at least in my upper left-hand corner, I'm not sure where it's on your screen, a timer. Each of you will have 15 minutes for presentation of your case in chief, with 5 minutes being reserved to appellate counsel for rebuttal if you choose to exercise that. And Mr. McGeaney, you are the appellate attorney. When you're ready to proceed, you may go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Haas. My name is Jim McGeaney, and I represent appellant Wayne Bothune in this appeal of a conviction out of Olmsted County District Court. The sole issue on appeal before this court is whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in admitting what was so-called Spriegel evidence against Mr. Bothune in the form of some child erotica stories that were located on an SD card that was found in a tablet in Mr. Bothune's residence during a search warrant. That tablet was connected to a computer printer, and it was the method for running that printer in the residence. It's a somewhat unique, in my opinion, circumstance, because the evidence that was admitted as prior bad acts or other crimes or bad acts evidence is not criminal. It was.
Well, I think we acknowledge that. I mean, my understanding of the facts, there was quite a bit more documents, or there wasn't a timely notice of the 25 child erotica snips that were submitted. So we're only talking about five of them, six of them.
There were six, Your Honor.
Part of your argument, as I understand it, is that it's not a crime to be in possession, but you're also arguing that there was not clear and convincing evidence that they belonged to your client. And can you focus on that first, as far as what is your best basis for saying that you are distanced from what was on his laptop, notepad, device? I'm not sure what to call it.
Certainly, Your Honor. The evidence showed, and it was known to the trial court in ruling on the Spriegel, that the stories that were located on that SD card were in a PDF format. And the state's expert who examined that card, the SD card, indicated and found that the stories hadn't been accessed since the latest 2011, most of them 2010, so many years.
But that's a part of the Spriegel analysis. If we look at how far in the past these matters would have occurred. But what I'm getting at is, I'm understanding your client is disputing that these were even on his device, or are you saying they were, but for all these other reasons, it should not have been admissible?
Yeah, I don't think we're arguing that the PDFs were not on the device. They were. I can see they were on the SD card. That card was within the tablet, and the tablet was connected to the printer. Our argument is that there's no evidence that Mr. Bothune was aware, that he had knowledge that those PDFs were on that card, on that SD card, that he had ever looked at them or read them. The counsel for the respondent gives an analogy about a diary and says, you know, if they were in a diary found on the bedside table, how could Mr. Bothune argue that he wasn't in possession or aware of them? I give the court a different analysis. If the law enforcement found a book, you know, a fiction book on my bookcase during a search warrant about creating or making bombs, that would be evidence that I could potentially be the Unabomber. There's no connection between the stories directly at Mr. Bothune, whether he was aware, read them, or ever printed them. There was no evidence that they'd ever been printed off that card. They were merely PDFs contained on the SD card. So they're too far disconnected from him to show that he was aware of them. I would concede, yes, that the card was in his home in the printer that he had. And there's some evidence in the record that other people had access to that printer, including the victim's mother and the victim's brother, who was subject to that other criminal complaint that's referenced briefly in the arguments, that a complaint was ultimately dismissed. So that's our argument about whether there's clear and convincing evidence that Mr. Bolfin possessed the contents of those stories. I would concede that the SD card was in his house. Does that answer the court's question?
It does, yes. Thank you. I'm just trying to make sure I'm following the argument. Thank you.
I understand. And even if this court and agrees with the trial court that Mr. Bolfin possessed those stories, there's still an error in allowing them to be used under a Spriegel analysis for the reasons outlined in my brief. I'd like to start with the assertion that the state's original Spriegel notice and memorandum, it was filed by counsel prior to Mr. Haas trying the case. Mr. Hagen filed a Spriegel memorandum. It's dated December 28th. It's referenced in the court record and in my brief. And in the state's memorandum to submit or admit these stories, I'll quote, "The state now moves to admit the introductions of 28 short stories," I concede only six came in, "as evidence of the defendant's motive to sexually abuse the victim." So the state's theory on admission of these stories from the beginning was to show motive. I know the state thinks that Cassidy's distinguishable. I respectfully disagree with the state's argument that...
Wait a minute. The judge in this case found that there was a common scheme or plan, although that was not raised by the state. Are you saying that the court could not do that?
Well, I disagree with the court's analysis that you can show common scheme or plan with evidence of fiction. In other words, it seems illogical that you can say that someone who reads, presuming that the appellant read these stories, and there's no evidence that he ever did, presuming that he did read these stories and he was aware of them, how can you have a common scheme or plan from a non-act? It's not an act. What's in the stories is another author's fiction. It's not Mr. Bolfin's creation. And so I don't think you could ever show common scheme or plan from someone who reads about another person's ideas as in relevance to that reader's actions. So I think the common scheme or plan analysis really only comes into play when you have the appellant or defendant who's actually participated in another bad act or crime. Mr. Bolfin didn't participate in actually doing another bad act. He's accused of being in possession of some other person's ideas about child erotica. So I disagree with the district court's analysis in that regards, and I also disagree with the district court's making that analysis when it wasn't argued. Does that answer the court's question? And so the district court found that the stories were relevant for the purpose of motive or intent, and that's in the addendum 3 in the court's order. And that's numbers 4 and 5. And the reason I cite Cassidy with reference to Ness is that this court found, and the Supreme Court found, that in that analysis, it's other child pornography in a case. This is not technically child pornography, but this is I don't like to use the word literature, but I can't think of another word this morning. This is literature that most people find repugnant. And therefore it's being called a bad act or an other bad act. But the court in Cassidy, citing to Ness, said that this type of evidence isn't admissible to show motive or intent. And so while it's true that Wickersham, you know, talked about the fact that that the court in Cassidy, you know, didn't do the right analysis because the Cassidy court said that the district court didn't find the appropriate reason. The district court in Cassidy did permit the admission of the evidence for motive or intent, and the appellate court ruled that that is improper. So the analysis for Cassidy is on point here. It's not appropriate to admit this type of, and I guess it's not child porn, but it's akin to child pornography found in the SD card. It's not appropriate to allow that evidence to be admissible to show motive or intent. And so I stand by the analysis from Cassidy that it was improper to allow this evidence to be admissible for motive or intent. And then the other reason that the court indicated was the common scheme will rebut fabrication. But again, those weren't argued by the initial motion by the state. When counsel took over the case from prior counsel, the subsequent Spriegel motion included the boilerplate language that every Spriegel motion that this court probably sees includes: lack of opportunity, motive, intent, common scheme, et cetera. But the gist of the state's argument in their memorandum, when we got prosecuting attorney and a new district court judge after the continuance was ordered, the gist of their argument.
Does that really make any difference? The way I understand it, Judge Wallace was first on the case, and there was discovery going on and not enough information. I mean, does it make any difference that another judge took over and picked it up cold?
Probably not for appellate purposes. I'm not arguing that at this point. We did argue at the district court about rule of the case, but we abandoned that argument for this court. But the point was, is that the gist of the state's argument in front of Judge Hain was not, they didn't change the purpose of the Spriegel. They just wanted the court to expand on the prior Spriegel ruling and allow more of the stories in and the entire content of the stories. So the state didn't come back to Judge Hain and say, oh, by the way, we think they're admissible to show common scheme or plan or motive. They came before the court and said, we think you should allow all the stories or more of the stories in. I think there were 28 total, and they wanted the entire stories to be admissible. And as the record reflects, prior to the continuance being granted before Judge Wallace, the state's agent, I guess the Rochester Police Department, had not actually provided the stories to the prosecuting attorney. They had only provided the summaries that we had gotten. And so no one had seen the stories. So the state got the stories from their officer and then moved the court. Hey, we want the entire story to be admissible. I don't know that the state's theory about the purpose changed, even though they did use the boilerplate Spriegel language in their second Spriegel motion. So we believe that the reasons that the evidence was admitted are erroneous or error, as well as the fact that the showing that Mr. Bothan actually possessed the Spriegel evidence.
What about the issue, Mr. McGinney, about that it had relevance to show lack of mistake or fabrication by the alleged victim?
Well, that was never
similar because of, and I'll finish my question, because of the similarity alleged between the stories and the conduct that was ultimately alleged in the complaint and that the jury found occurred.
I would submit, I think I would concede that it would have been relevant if it was behavior by Mr. Bothan. In other words, if there was evidence that he had done these things in prior incidents, that it probably would be admissible for lack of mistake or fabrication. But the evidence shows that there was no prior behavior by Mr. Bothan. In fact, there's no evidence in the record that the stories that were on the SD card were ever read by Mr. Bothan, that he was aware of them, that they'd ever been printed on that printer. They did it, you know.
But he was, as the state argues, it kind of defies logic that he didn't. I mean, he was in the computer business and industry, right?
He testified he was IT. Yeah, he did some computer support. But there was no evidence that he's somehow an expert. And he testified under oath that he was not aware that the stories were on the card. But even if he was aware, the evidence from the state's expert was that they had not been accessed nor print. They had not been accessed, even looked at, for almost 9 years. Nor had they was there any evidence that they'd ever actually been printed. And the Officer Novak, the state's I'll call him IT expert, he did a thorough analysis of the devices that were found, and he was unable to testify that those stories had ever even been printed. So there was no evidence that Mr. Balthen, even if he was aware that they were there, ever actually accessed them. But again, these are someone else's thoughts and ideas put down in a PDF. They're not necessarily Mr. Bolton's thoughts and ideas. They're the authors of those stories. There's no evidence that he authored those stories. So again, it goes back to the state's analysis about the diary. It's not Mr. Bolthen's diary. It's somebody else's. And so if I'm in possession of someone else's diary, does that mean that shows my common scheme or plan because I'm looking at someone else's stuff? And I see that I'm out of time, so I'm happy to address any other questions on rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Good eye on the timer. And we'll turn it over to respondent counsel.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Jim Haas. I'm an assistant Olmsted County attorney, and I'm appearing on behalf of the respondent, State of Minnesota. I tried to state my position as plainly as I could in my brief, and I guess at this time, I would do my best to answer any questions the panel might have for me.
Well, I have some questions, and this is just to help analyze it, because there seems to be so much overlap between talking about both perhaps in the brief, in the law, in the district court's opinion, I'm not sure where, perhaps just in my mind, but we talk about, I'm trying to isolate what we are actually, how we actually evaluate it, because it talks about, for example, I'm looking at your brief, the district court found might be admissible to show motive. And then you write, I'm on 13 and 14 of your brief, more specifically, in finding the case admissible to rebut claims of victim fabrication, comma, under a common scheme or plan analysis, comma. I'm not sure our motive, common scheme or plan, and rebut claims of victim fabrication, three independent bases under Spriegel, or how do they relate and where do we get to? I'm having trouble following it analytically.
I think of the symbol of the Olympics with those circles that overlap each other. And that's what I conjure to mind when I try to wrap my, you know, head around these same questions. And I think some of these things do overlap. To me, the most forceful one flows from Spriegel itself and Vermeerskirchen. In the specific context of child sexual abuse, is to rebut claims of fabrication. But I think motive kind of bleeds into that. Intent bleeds into that concept as well. So I'm not sure I can give you a concise answer, but I think there's certainly a lot of overlap, and it's kind of more fact specific.
Can you respond to the idea? So I guess you would say, well, tell me if you would say this. Does it have to satisfy a common scheme or plan in order for, because, you know, the argument is this is very different from other common scheme or plan cases where it's like, oh, you look at, you know, there have been three such crimes, for example, criminal acts that are identical. I mean, here it's different. It's that there are, you know, the stories and then the charged offense. Does it have to satisfy that in order to be admissible to rebut an allegation of victim, fabrication?
Well, I thought about this notion of, you know, propensity, for example. We often say you can't just argue once a thief, always a thief. And why is that? Well, because in, you know, common law crimes like theft, frankly, it's not all that probative. We all like nice things. We all aspire to greater wealth, and we can appreciate how a person, if presented the opportunity, might take something or steal or embezzle. And frankly, Spriegel type evidence is not necessarily that probative. But when it comes to, you know, adults having sex with 4-year-old children, that sort of thing is so far outside the mainstream that it's it's frankly hard for people to understand it. And when a defendant testifies and says, I didn't do it, and why would anybody do such, you know, a disgusting thing? She must have fabricated that. That's the only explanation. That's why the cases in Spriegel and Vermeerskirchen can discuss historically the unique probative nature of these sorts of things in dealing with acts of perversion on small children, because it is beyond the ken of for your average juror. And so whether you call it motive, intent, modus operandi, or just simply evidence to prove the corpus delicti, that it wasn't fabricated, it may be different ways of saying the same concept. But I think the very unique relevance in this case, as in Spriegel and Vermeerskirchen, was to refute the claim that this child, the sole witness to this crime, is making it up.
And so does that depend? You talked about that if the defendant testifies and says that it was fabricated. Did the defendant end up testifying here? Remind me.
Yes, the defendant took the stand and denied any.
But the decision was made, I suppose, before the defendant had to. I mean, I think it was mentioned even maybe in opening statements. Is that right? The decision was made to admit, it seemed, but maybe not. Was it independent of whether the defendant intended to testify? Because it seems like a lot of these cases would be the victim, you know, that what the victim is saying is just completely fabricated. It has to be put to its proof to prove it happened. And it seemed like it would be quite a big hole.
Maybe two questions in there. Document 49 was our second motion that I filed on March 17th that Judge Hain ruled upon pre-trial, and she gave an extensive written analysis of all that preemptively gave us sort of the parameters of how this evidence could be admitted in the state's case in chief. But as for arguments, I was very careful not to mention this at all in my opening statement. I never mentioned this evidence in my closing argument. The first time it was mentioned in argument was in Mr. McGeaney's closing argument, and I responded in rebuttal. But I frankly took the chance, had Mr. McGeaney not addressed it in closing argument, I'm not sure I would or could have addressed it in my rebuttal. So maybe try to answer two points that came up. So there was a preemptive ruling by Judge Hain in writing that clarified the parameters. That second motion, your court can read it for itself in document 49. It expanded upon this in the sense that, one, I stuck with the same six stories that Judge Wallace had previously ruled admissible. But now that we had the full text, what I asked was that the entire story be admitted. And originally, Judge Wallace had allowed the state to make written exhibits, to type it up. And the state's, I think, intent, what Mr. Hagen's thought, was to just offer it as an exhibit that went back to the jury. Judge Hain was clear that the way this would be entered is just through testimony, no physical exhibits. But she provided a little context. She said that, you know, the officer can say, you know, this was the title, this was the synopsis, it was how many pages, and what the relationship was between the adult and the child, the age, and just was the synopsis, you know, consistent with the nature of the story. Yeah. And all that came in through testimony.
Thank you for that. You know, detail. But and just then to clarify that I wonder if we lost. Got distracted because I saw. Oh, there we go. Is that the district court though did decide that that what came in on the six stories could come in the state's case in chief, right?
Correct.
And so we sort of get to, I mean, whether or not the defendant was going to testify. So they could come in to rebut an allegation of fabrication in the state's case in chief, right?
Yes, and for other reasons she listed. That was one of them, but she also discussed modus operandi. Also, one of the counts required a sexual intent. There was a contact. The penetration does not require it, or the genital to genital, but other sexual contact requires a proof of sexual intent. And this dealt with the bathing. So, you know, you could bathe the child and touch their private parts without sexual intent. And Judge Hain discussed in her order how this could be offered by the state to show a sexual intent during the contact during bathing, that it wasn't just incidental or for caretaking purposes.
And so when I look at your brief, what rationale, what purpose, I guess, is the right word, is it admissible on? I don't see you arguing that latter argument in your brief. So if you can just explain, I mean, when I look at, your table of contents, it seems to be about that the victim fabricated this sexual abuse. And then I guess wrapped up into that is this mm-hmm. common scheme and plan idea or something.
I think it was Secretary Rumsfeld that said that you go to the war with what you got, right? The strongest cases that really focused on this, I felt, were Vermeerskirchen, Spriegel, that expressly addressed child, sexual abuse and those sorts of cases, and focused on this concept of we're dealing with cases where there rarely are independent witnesses to these kinds of cases. And the obvious inferences when the defendant denies it is, well, so I'm not so sure you need to have the defendant testify expressly to suggest that this child might have fabricated it. That defense, I think, can be raised without the defendant's testimony. We have that testimony here. So even if the district court's decision was premature, it certainly came to fruition in this case. And I think this court can look at the court's pretrial ruling in context of the trial and should. So maybe that's a distinction without meaning in this case. I think that these concepts, they bleed together. Judge Hain went through them in detail in her written order, and I think she's correct. I tried to focus in my brief on what I felt was the strongest arguments. I still support the other bases that Judge Hain had in her order, but I guess I tried to hone in on my best argument in the brief, which again is more fact specific to this aspect of particularly young children being sexually abused.
Mr. Hayes, as I listen to the arguments here, I'm kind of struck with, I know the state has consistently framed this as a Spriegel issue, and that is the way the district court analyzed it. But is it really a Spriegel issue, or is it just a relevance issue?
Well, what maybe the court at the district court, I literally took this case over on a Friday afternoon, and I appeared on Monday to argue Mr. Hagen's Spriegel notice. And I think early that morning, I sent a few cases into the Judge Wallace's law clerk and to Mr. McGeaney. And one alternative argument I suggested, this may not be Spriegel at all. This may just be immediate episode evidence of the case that was just discovered in the course of the actual investigation. Now, I'm not sure that's the hill I care to die on, so to speak, and that wasn't maybe the strong, and the district court really didn't give that argument much weight. But I think there's a bit of a spectrum here. So if the court's question is, is this just a matter of, is it even Spriegel? Is it a, so I'm seeing the court sort of frozen in my screen. Is there any connect? Can you all hear me?
I can hear you. I haven't, we're missing somebody.
Yeah, Judge Flory's video has gone off a couple of times, but hopefully he's hearing us.
His question seemed to be on par.
I think we lost Judge Flory.
Yes, I think we did. We're at a little bit over 2 minutes. Let's see if we can reach him. That'll give you an opportunity to figure your summation.
Can I pause the timer?
Yes, please do it. Set it back to 2 minutes and 10 seconds. He's materialized. Judge Flory, for whatever reason, you disappeared off the screen. So what we did is we've set the clock back to 2 minutes and 10 seconds, and we'll let Mr. Haas conclude his remarks.
Thank you. I'm not sure where the court left off, but I think the question was one of relevance. And I guess that's the fundamental question in any Spriegel analysis, the balancing of its probative value against unfair prejudice. But the district court found, as I argued, that this is highly probative. Again, in these cases of child sexual abuse, where we have a young child who's the sole witness to this case. And again, I fall back on Spriegel, Dermer-Skirkin, and the case law that discussed that particularly unique probative value to that. Without a question on the floor, if I might have an opportunity to discuss the Cassidy case that counsel raises, and in fact that I had brought to Judge Wallace's attention and below, I think it's distinguishable in a number of ways. First of all, is the lack of analysis by the district court. This court said the only record of the basis for the district court's ruling allowing the introduction of the evidence was the court statement. I won't read it, but it was pretty cursory and there was very little analysis. It was just read from the bench. Unlike here, where we have very detailed written order after a full hearing. Secondly, is the similarities. In Cassidy, the video was two post-pubescent girls engaged, or young, I guess they were underage, engaging in acts. And he was charged with a prepubescent child. In our case, there's much more marked similarities between the stories and the acts alleged. And finally, just the prejudice of showing straight pornography, a video in the trial court in Cassidy, compared with the far more sanitized version of the evidence presented here. And again, as I argue to the jury, it's not a crime to possess these stories, which again underscores the lack of the prejudice, but they were uniquely probative. And I think the district court did not abuse its discretion by its admission.
Thank you, Mr. Haas. We'll turn back to you, Mr. Magini. You have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few points on Mr. Haas's argument. I'll also address Judge Flory because, Judge, I had the same thought process was going on in the lower court about whether this was even Spriegel evidence.
Well, you know, Mr. Magini, let's have a discussion about that because that I thought of that too. And I thought, frankly, for your client, there is more due process protections to have the evidence analyzed under Spriegel than it would under relevance. I mean, wouldn't we be looking at only at an abuse of discretion by the trial court if it was the relevance of the evidence? I mean, I would think that you'd want a Spriegel analysis because it gives you the argument to talk about the distance and time and so on.
Well, we agree that the analysis is probably correct, but I wanted to address the question. And I think in a relevance analysis, I think we'd have the same issue about the unfair prejudice. Is the relevance overcome by the potential for unfair prejudice? And while I appreciate counsel's description of sanitized, read the transcript. What Officer Novak read into the record regarding what was on the SD card is graphic and extremely highly prejudicial. You know, the district court acknowledged that this was prejudicial, but then indicated that the prejudice would be overcome by limiting the number of stories being referenced to the jury, and the rather than the entire content of the stories. But the descriptions that were read were the most graphic things in the stories. In other words, they describe graphic sexual contact. So by snipping out some of the most graphic descriptions from a story and having it read didn't sanitize those stories in any way. There was nothing the district court was going to be able to do to limit or lessen the potential for unfair prejudice in this case. And I think that's especially relevant when you're talking about stories that are in a literature format, you know, in a book on PDF, I guess, rather than as, and I appreciate counsel's pronouncing of Wickersham, because I can't say that case no matter how many times I try. In the cases that analyze this type of evidence, those are are cases where the defendant or the appellant has actually participated in similar type conduct, not where they've been in possession of some author's description of similar type conduct. And I agree, these are unique cases. And I think that's grounds to really be cautious when talking about Spriegel evidence, because, you know, when a jury hears allegations about child sexual abuse, that's repugnant. That raises, that inflames a juror's passions, no matter how hard you try not to. I can't think of a juror who doesn't get impassioned about these allegations. And so now when you suggest that, in my opinion anyway, these stories are nothing more than propensity evidence. Someone who looks at this stuff in Penthouse magazine or some other forum is more likely to have committed an offense that they denied doing, rather than this evidence is relevant, as Judge Smith was asking, to show a common scheme or plan or rebut fabrication. So I disagree with the idea that the unfair prejudice didn't outweigh the potential probative value, whether or not you call it Spriegel evidence or any other evidence. But we are here on a Spriegel ruling and a Spriegel analysis by the district court. And I just want to address quickly, I know counsel says he didn't mention any of this evidence in opening or closing argument. Well, that's true. That doesn't negate the fact that the jury heard this evidence from the state's expert IT witness, and he read those descriptions into the record. I don't know if this court has access to the recorded files, but he used, he inflected in the stories. I don't want to use the language, but so-and-so did this and so-and-so did that to this person. In my opinion, he didn't just read the stories in a straight manner. He accentuated some of the really awful conduct that most people would think is awful, although not illegal. So anyway, I see I'm out of time again. Thank you for the court's time. And I prefer the Zoom platform myself. It saves us 3 hours of windshield time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both of you. The argument.